Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Steve Gabriel, a permaculture practitioner and teacher from New York here in the United States, and a member of the extension team at Cornell University. Steve is a past guest on the show, so you'll find a link in the show notes back to his earlier interview so you can find out more about him and the work that he does. Our conversation today is an introduction to the idea of cultivating mushrooms on woody material. Specifically, we touch on four species of mushroom: shiitake, oyster, lion's mane, and Stropharia. Stropharia is also known as the wine cap mushroom. We do end a bit abruptly, but where things end is where I was planning to bring the show to a close to originally. And in the time, we covered everything that I wanted to in this introduction to farming mushrooms. You can find out more about the work at Cornell and the research that Steve's involved in a document titled Best Management Practices for Log-Based Shiitake Cultivation in the Northeast United States. As that was quite a lot for me to say, it'd be quite a lot for you to write down, so you'll find a link to that article in the show notes as well. I plan to have Steve back on to answer listener questions in the future, so if you have any regarding these four types of mushrooms or anything you hear within the interview, let me know, and I'll pass them along to Steve so he can join us again. Because of this conversation with Steve, I was encouraged to take the plunge into growing my own mushrooms. I'll include some more information about that after the interview in this episode to talk about those experiences so far. You will find pictures from the day that I spent plugging shiitake mushrooms in the show notes as well. I'm also going to be inoculating with the Stropharia around my own property in the next few days, and we'll post pictures of that process as it comes together. Finally, before we get to the interview, your support as a listener allows me to continue this show, as well as to explore interesting permaculture-related projects, such as growing mushrooms. If you find this interview or the other materials I post helpful to your own path, help me carry on and share this information with others so that we can create a better world. Go to www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and make a one-time or ongoing contribution. Now then, on to Steve Gabriel. Well then, Steve, Mr. Gabriel, let us get this conversation about mushrooms started. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on your current work with cultivating mushrooms, and we can take it from there.
Okay, sure. So my background is really, I sort of stumbled upon fungi. We're getting on to the eighth year now, when I was working at a nature center, and we were actually thinning our sugar bush at the time and had all these extra logs, and I was kind of feeling a little out of sorts about kind of burning all this wood that we were harvesting, and I figured there's probably other things we could do with this material, and so found a fella up the road who was rumored to be growing mushrooms in his woods, and we contacted him and brought him out for a class, and, you know, probably left us with about 20 logs, and I fruited them the next year, and I was hooked. The first time a log popped out of the mushroom, I was sold. And so I've been mostly working for many years on my own, just experimentally, and then got involved with Cornell Extension. And when I started working here in 2009, wrote a few grants with Professor Ken Mudge, and we have been promoting mostly at this point. We have a good almost decade of mushroom research under our belts, or Cornell does and other institutions. So a lot of our work now has shifted from what's possible to getting the word out and helping to encourage especially farmers to start thinking about this as a possible niche crop. But it's really something that works great for any scale of production in a permaculture type system.
And in this conversation, we're going to be talking about the cultivation of mushrooms as a systemized practice. This is not about foraging or wildcrafting for mushrooms.
Yeah, I personally love to do some foraging, although I find my time during that season to be limited because I'm managing all my logs. But yeah, there's definitely a difference, and we can talk a little bit about some of the different types of mushrooms we find. And there's certainly there's a few species that we can both find in the woods and cultivate, but a lot of them, either you find them or you grow them. So yeah, that's kind of the distinction there.
And I think about a lot of the mushrooms that we have like the oyster mushroom or the shiitake Are all of these naturally found in the woodlands in the United States, or are these things that have been introduced and inoculated and grown here?
Well, it's if you imagine all the work that's gone into breeding around plants, mushrooms, it's such a tiny fraction. You know, compare all the work thinking about apples or something, and mushrooms have been almost untouched. A lot of what's happened is people have found a specimen in the wild, and they said, this is a great mushroom. I'm going to try to grow it out and essentially try to cultivate it, you know, mimic its habitat, if you will. So what we have today are, there's really four species we're going to talk about, I think, in terms of cultivation, because we're limiting ourselves, at least in my work, to forest-grown mushrooms and log-grown mushrooms. So there's a whole branch of cultivation that's indoor and that's on a lot of different substrates like sawdust and grain and things like that and manure. We're really thinking about outdoor cultivation on mostly on logs and wood chips because it's sort of more readily available to everyone. And so within that, we have four species. We have shiitake, oyster, lion's mane, and Stropharia. And out of those four, three of them are native to North America. The only one that's not is shiitake, which is actually an Asian mushroom from China and Japan.
I love these conversations for the things that I learn every day. I suspected that shiitake was introduced, but with the way that language ebbs and flows and we pick up different words from different places, I just didn't know if that was something that was discovered here and given a name by an Asian immigrant or if it was introduced, and now I know. Of these three that you mentioned, the one, Stropharia, I am not familiar with.
Yeah, Stropharia is, the Latin name is Stropharia rugosa annulata, and sometimes it's called garden giant or red wine cap. And that's one that shows up more actually in, surprisingly, in sunny and part sun conditions, and sometimes in lawns. At Extension, we've gotten a number of calls from people terrified of some mushroom showing up in their lawn, and sometimes it actually is a Stropharia, which is exciting. And so it's just one of these species that you can find certainly wild in the right conditions, although it seems to partner well with human activity. So one of the best sort of quote-unquote wild patches I ever found was with a coworker here at Cornell behind the ag library. The landscaping crew had actually spread out a bunch of wood chips that just happened to have Stropharia mycelium in it, and we were harvesting a lot of mushrooms from that patch. And you know, so it seems like they find their way often into wood chips, and so sometimes you know, picking up a load of wood chips at the local town pile, you can actually bring Stropharia right into your system, which is kind of cool.
One of my permaculture fellows used to talk about, what did he call them, the EBMs?
No, LBMs.
LDMs, yes. I can get this right. The LBMs, the little brown mushrooms you find everywhere?
Yeah. Yeah, the joke is that, you know, most mushrooms are neither edible nor poisonous. Most of them are just sort of these random fungi that show up, and they're doing great things for the ecosystem, but they're not something we necessarily want to eat or be afraid of. So we name a lot of them LBMs because honestly, you know, if you took all the time to identify every mushroom out there in the world, you wouldn't have any time to eat the ones you want to eat.
And this allows us to focus on the good ones that we enjoy. And I have to say that oyster mushrooms are one of my favorites whenever they come in to saute up in some butter with a little bit of garlic and then toss some eggs in with it for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're getting to the good stuff.
That's right. Yeah, pretty much, really with mushrooms, the great thing is you really just need, you know, butter or oil and a hot pan and you're pretty much good to go. So
before this turns into a cooking episode, let's talk about the cultivation of these mushrooms with these four varieties that you laid out for us to talk about. Which would be the one that you would recommend people start with?
Sure. Well, let me give one more piece of background just for folks to consider that if you're buying mushrooms in the grocery store these days, probably 99% almost positive that those are coming from an indoor cultivated system. And even the shiitakes and oysters are coming from something very different than this woods cultivation. And interestingly enough, in they say in the U.S., over 90% of the mushrooms we eat are Agaricus bisporus. They're the button mushrooms. And actually, the cremini, which is a brown button mushroom, and the portobello are all the same. They're all derived originally from the same species. And so you know, one of my exciting things is we're able to kind of increase our palette of possibilities. And definitely the low-hanging fruit, the one everyone should consider starting with, especially those people who like to succeed easily and have good results, you know, as quick as possible sort of thing, have get a yield, as we say in permaculture, right, is the shiitake. The other ones are really a bit of hit or miss in terms of when they actually fruit, but the shiitake is very reliable, and you can actually almost set your watch to it. You can actually schedule flushings. And so for my, you know, for our farm, we can actually guarantee a certain number of pounds per week to restaurants or other customers. And this is what really makes it exciting, whether you're selling or whether you're just thinking in your backyard for yourself, because, you know, reliable yields of food is one of these real challenges with a lot of different things we're trying to grow. And the shiitake just, it lends itself perfectly to this kind of cultivation.
How is that more reliable and different from some of these others? Is there a particular process going on with this mushroom that allows you to, as you say, set your watch to it? Is there a way to force this kind of flushing, or is it just that it occurs so regularly?
It's really in the forcing that's really key. I think you hit upon it. That's what we call when we can kind of, basically it's called shocking or forcing, which is when we create sort of a stimulus for fruiting. The general ways you do that is either with moisture or with temperature. And obviously, if you're growing out in the woods, you're not going to really be able to alter the temperature so much. And that's often what happens actually indoors, is sometimes people will shock, like oyster that are grown on straw, for instance. You can sometimes put them in the fridge and then get some response. But, you know, in the woods, we can't really control that. So with shiitakes, what's great is you can actually soak these logs in a tank of water for about 24 hours is usually what people recommend. And then within a week, you're going to get a flush of mushrooms. And so you can kind of time it to know, you know, okay, I want to harvest these next Wednesday. So this Wednesday, I better soak some logs and pull them out on Thursday, basically. So that's the nice thing about it, is you can really plan ahead and get good yields. You can also leave them alone and get them to fruit, you know, when the conditions are right. But the yields off sort of natural fruiting when you don't soak are definitely much less than when you actually force fruit them.
Comparing natural fruiting versus forced fruiting, now these mushrooms are using the logs that you're inoculating as both their growing medium and their nutrients?
Yeah, which sort of the structure in the food at the same time. Yeah, you're actually, you know, shiitake, because it's not a native species, is actually a pretty weak competitor out there in the world. And so what you're doing as the human is you're actually introducing shiitake to a fresh log that hasn't been contaminated by anything else, and doing it in a pretty dense way. You're putting a lot of spawn, you know, relative to the amount of log. And then that mushroom essentially eats through the log over the next 3 or 4 years. Both the log, it's the bark of the log protects the mushroom from other competitive fungi, and then it also feeds it. And so that's where different tree species come into play, which is not fully understood why some work better than others, but certainly something about the nutrient content, sugar content, moisture, retention capabilities, all these things really support good shiitake growth.
You mentioned that you can get a log to produce for 3 or 4 years. Are you noticing a difference in your experimentation between letting a log naturally fruit versus forcing a fruiting?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, I think in general we can say that there's, you know, only so much food in the pantry, so to speak. So if you force a log, you're encouraging that mushroom to grow more vigorously, and so the life of the log is shorter. If you leave them out into the woods, some growers report, we haven't done a lot of research because a lot of our focus has been on, you know, the farm-based stuff, and so we really want to encourage people to soak. But we've heard people say if they don't soak them that they can last 6 or 8 years and still fruit. So yeah, it really just depends on the intensity, I guess, of cultivation.
Always room for more research and experimentation with this. It's exciting to see mushrooms entering into more and more of the conversation within the permaculture community as we move towards more experimentation with these systems, to be able to share this information and see the results and find models of what to use in different areas. When you're talking about a focus on the farm basis, with shiitakes, you're say that they're pretty reliable. With these other three, how are you producing those in a way that are meaningful for a farm style of production?
Yeah, well, I think that's an open-ended case. We're actively actually looking at that right now. We're working with three different farms, as well as some of our sites at Cornell, to figure that out. And so, you know, we can get a little into the details of how you actually inoculate. But what we find with the lion's mane and the oyster, which are both done on hardwood logs as well, is that they tend to like to respond more to temperature swings. And so outdoors, what we have is good fruiting sometimes in the spring or fall or both, but not so much in the hot part of the year, you know, unless there's a real cool spell. The Stropharia is really the mystery. It's really fun to plant it all over the place, essentially, and just kind of be surprised, honestly. I mean, it really, I have planted it in so many circumstances, and it's fruited, you know, 10 feet away from where I planted it, or I didn't remember when I moved some wood chips that had it in it, and the patch showed up a year later. I mean, it's really, at our landscape, it's at this great point where we don't actually even know where we've established it. It just exists, and it's really part of the whole ecosystem, and it's awesome. I mean, I, you know, last fall got 20 pounds in one flush after a heavy rain, and it was a treasure hunt. It's almost like foraging in your own system, you know. So I think it's really cool. And that one, you know, so think about that. Okay, so those are really random. And Stropharia, we think, responds both to temperature and to moisture, but we haven't been able to sort of simulate that and force it to fruit. We're going to try to put a sprinkler on some of our patches at Cornell this year and see if we can kind of stimulate fruiting. But as it goes right now, it's sort of icing on the top of the cake. So when we talk to farmers, what we say is build a business off of shiitake, put all your eggs in that basket, so to speak, and then start to grow some of these other ones on the side. And if you have good markets, when those fruit, because they will fruit, we just don't know when or how much, you'll have a market for them already. And so all the chefs I work with, you know, anytime I can bring them Stropharia or lion's mane or oyster, they're happy to buy as whatever I can produce, you know. And I just say, well, I'll let you know, but no guarantees.
Your description of distributing Stropharia a little bit of everywhere to experiment with it. My daughter is getting ready to lose some of her baby teeth, so we've been talking about the tooth fairy. And I just have that kind of an image of a mushroom fairy, spreading spawn a little here and a little there.
It's wonderful. The first time we ever did a patch was at the Permaculture Institute in the Finger Lakes, and we made this really nice bed for these mushrooms. We bought really nice new, there were white ash wood chips, and we made this nice little bed for them, and we inoculated it, and we watered it, and we really like took care of it. And the mushrooms ended up migrating out of that bed of chips into the pine straw that was just in the forest already, and then they actually fruited from that, right? So the lesson I constantly learn with mushrooms is to not take them too seriously and to play with them, and they're going to find the right environment. We just kind of try to create those conditions, you know, and the Stropharia especially is really kind of up for grabs, and it's a really fun one to experiment with.
Now, I pulled up a picture of the Stropharia, and they look like they can get pretty big. Is there a particular size at which you harvest them to eat?
Yeah, in general, with cap and stem style mushrooms, with, you know, usually having gills underneath and a separate cap and stem, and this goes for the shiitake as well. When we get to oyster and hericium, the lion's mane, that's a whole different story, but for the Stropharia and the shiitake, you want to have that cap open, and you want to have the rim of the mushroom, if you can imagine, be somewhat still there. So there's somewhat of an edge that you can kind of run your finger around the edge, the inside edge of the mushroom. Once that mushroom starts to actually flatten out, is kind of past prime, still probably edible, but just not perfect. And what's happening there biologically is that the mushroom is actually releasing spores. And so that middle point, when you have kind of a rim around the edge, is actually the maximum spore production. And that's actually what gives a lot of the flavor and aroma of what we enjoy to eat. And so that's really what it comes down to, is past that point, you start to just decline in sort of flavor and therefore in enjoyment, right? So we teach a lot. We really show people a lot about the sort of proper time to harvest. That's one of the things that we have some pictures in our guide about. because that's a really important feature. And they also store a lot longer when they're harvested at the right time.
You mentioned that the shiitake and lion's mane and oyster are all inoculated on hardwood logs. The stropharia then is in wood chips?
Let's go through the three different types of inoculations, if that works with you.
No, that's perfect. That's exactly where I was going.
Cool. Okay, so shiitake mushrooms, we recommend you inoculate them in what are called bolts. And a bolt is simply a log that is 4 to 8 inches in diameter and usually about 3 feet long. And what we do to inoculate those is we drill holes in the log about every 4 inches apart. We'll drill a roll, and then we'll rotate the log and start another row, another 2 inches from that. And we'll just go around the log until it's filled with holes, okay? And then the spawn is inserted into that log. And there's a couple different options of how to do that. I'm not going to maybe go there right now. It's in our fact sheets. But you put the spawn in the log, and then you wax over top of all those little holes. Usually an average log has maybe 50 or 60 of these drilled holes that you're inoculating. So you're just really spreading that spawn throughout the entire log. So that's shiitake. And that's pretty labor intensive, actually. So what we found is that with the lion's mane and the oyster, the better method is actually what's called a totem inoculation, all right? And totem inoculation is where you take a log that is a little bit wider, basically something that you could stand on its butt end and it won't fall over. And we usually cut them at about 2 feet long, and then we'll cut that log in half. So we have 2 1-foot sections. And then we actually cut a little cookie, what we call a cookie, just a few inch piece off the top. Okay, so there's 3 sections. Then we set those up wherever we want to inoculate, and we actually layer the spawn in between each section of log. So we put some on the bottom, some in between the 2 big pieces, some on the top, and we put that little cookie piece right on the top of the second piece. And that whole thing is called a totem, and you can imagine why. It's kind of stacking up on top of each other. That's much faster. It's much quicker inoculation. And, you know, it seems to produce mushrooms of these species a lot better as compared to the bolt method. And then the stropharia is basically, yeah, wood chips or straw is sort of the substrate. What we call a substrate is something you feed essentially the mushroom to. And what we usually do for that, my favorite method is to clear away a patch of bare ground, essentially put down about 2 inches of sawdust, throw some spawn in with that, and then put another 2 to 4 inches of wood chips on top. And that's really it for the stropharia. So that's actually probably the quickest of them all. And a bag of stropharia will do about a 4 by 4 foot section, so like 16 square feet of space.
And you're not worried about trying to pasteurize those wood chips or anything like that?
No, this is the great thing. You know, indoor cultivation is all about sterilizing and pasteurizing and all those kind of things. With the outdoor stuff, what we have is that stropharia is it's uninterested in competition. It really can actually exist with a lot of other species of mushrooms. And then the wood for the other ones, the bark and the freshness of the logs, that's really important, as a lot of people think they can inoculate, you know, the tree that fell down their backyard 2 years ago or something. It really has to be fresh wood. And the bark of that wood actually is what, you know, protects the and sort of creates a sterile enough environment for these different, you know, other species.
And that answered my next question about the shiitake not being a good competitor, about waxing the holes to keep out competitors, but that gets quite to it. With these, there are particular wood types that are better for each of these types of mushrooms?
Yes, yes. This is all these little details. This is why I always joke when I give a class, there's going to be a quiz at the end of the class because there's so many little things. So to keep it simple, with shiitake, the best species are oak, and actually shiitake in Japanese means mushroom of the oak. So oak and red oak, white oak, chestnut oak, any of those, swamp oak. Sugar maple is great for shiitake, and beech, American beech, is great for shiitake. For oyster, what we found, although we haven't done super extensive work with oyster and tried a lot of different species, we've seem to have the best luck on like softer hardwoods. It's this really confusing thing, right? So hardwood, by forester sort of terminology, a hardwood is any tree that leafs out. And so when we say softer hardwoods, I'm thinking of trees like poplar, cottonwood, willow, alder, those kind of things could all be good species for oyster. All right. And then with the lion's mane, usually what we found at Cornell is the best species by far is American beech for those. Although some people also prefer to use sugar maple. For the Stropharia, it really doesn't matter. You use ideally a mixture of wood chips. I mentioned that example earlier. We used, you know, all one species. It actually is better to use a mix of species. And I found that actually partially broken down wood chips are best. So I tend to root around in our, you know, our local town pile and find something that's a little bit decomposed and that's definitely not all one species. They seem to like a diverse mix there.
What about some of our softer woods like pine or hemlock? Are there any mushrooms that can be cultivated in that material?
Yeah, not so much that we've had success with. The challenge with the conifers is the resins that are in the wood. And so that really inhibits a lot of mycelial growth. It's actually one of their adaptive strategies. The only possible species to play with would be hemlock. Hemlock could potentially grow chicken of the woods, and it could also grow reishi, although I'll warn your listeners that we've had zero success cultivating those two species. And we hear random reports here and there of people that have success, but not a lot of success on the conifer end.
And that was Steve Gabriel. If you enjoyed this conversation and would like to learn more from Steve, the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute is running an in-person 15-day intensive permaculture design course in New York from July 25th to August 10th, 2014. Go to fingerlakespermaculture.org to find out more information and register if you'd be able to attend. From the encouragement that Steve offered, my own mushroom inoculation experience is limited to doing some research and ordering my mushroom spawn and then spending a day where my friend and photographer John joined me to plug logs along with some assistance from my son over a single day. What I learned from that experience is that, as Steve indicated, it is a labor-intensive process to drill and plug logs. Using a starter kit from Field and Forest Products, Inc., paired with a hand drill, meant that it took us about 45 minutes to inoculate each log after we got set up and figured out a production system. Combined with the video and picture production time, we ran until we were running out of comfortable daylight, and my wife was calling all three of us to dinner. In order to drill the 50 holes, plug and seal them for each log was a rather intense but satisfying experience. Overall, we were able to plug 5 logs that day with shiitake plug spawn. 3 were red maple and 2 were red oak. And now, as time allows for it, I'm picking my way through some other relatively fresh logs to plug more shiitake and some reishi. I have enough spawn for both to plug 10 more shiitake and 5 reishi. As the three of us work together, mostly John and I while my son helped sweep and clean up and hand us tools, I realized that a team of 4 or 5 people per station would have made this go a lot quicker. 1 person involved in drilling, 2 people plugging, 1 person to wax. That potential 5th person I think would fill in really nicely if they helped to turn the log for the driller in order to keep production moving, and then would help get the next log for the driller as the pluggers picked that log up and moved it to their section. If I were to do this again with the plug spawn, I think that I would actually not use the plugs, but use sawdust spawn and an inoculation tool instead, and do it that way so that I could get a high-speed cutter, the kind that would attach to an angle grinder, rather than trying to use a hand drill. It just wasn't that quick to get those holes made and to keep things going. Drilling really was the place where we were getting hung up the most. And it looks like using the sawdust spawn for the Stropharia along with wood chips is going to be much easier. And as I say, I'll know that here in a couple of days after this episode comes out, as I'll be inoculating with 5 pounds of sawdust spawn around my home design. Even though I have some time before I'll be able to harvest the mushrooms, I've really enjoyed experimenting with them and hope that you'll take my step forward with this as encouragement to try your own hand at these species of mushrooms as well. Download the article from the team at Cornell for more ideas on how to grow your own mushrooms, as well as information on the cost and potential yields. Then check out the Field and Forest Products Inc. website, fieldforest.net, and see what is appropriate to grow where you are. I wound up using this company because I've been in touch with their staff for 2 or 3 years, ever since I first got the idea of wanting to grow my own mushrooms. And I've called and asked questions and had them answered, and they've been very generous with me over the years in helping me get appropriately prepared for the projects that I was working on, and really treating me well as a customer throughout the entire process. And I've really liked that experience. So yeah, go check out what they've got and see what you might want to grow. And if you have any questions along the way, let me know, and I'll pass them to Steve to see if he can clarify what he can, or direct us to appropriate resources, and have him back on the air again to talk about growing mushrooms in more depth. The usual ways to get in touch are email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or by phone, 717-827-6266. You can also see more pictures from my experiments at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow the show on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Until the next time, do your best to create a better world every day by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.